I'm your host, Alexander Hefner, and you're listening to the audio podcast of The Open Mind. I'm Alexander Hefner, your host on The Open Mind. My guest today is Professor Danielle Citron. She is the Jefferson Scholars Foundation Distinguished Professor in Law at the University of Virginia, where she teaches and writes about privacy, free expression, and civil rights and their connections to the future of democracy. Danielle, a pleasure to host you today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me ask you, since you delivered what is a millions times over viewed TED Talk on deepfakes and their potentially disastrous impact on society and democracy, that was 2019, right?
Yes. So 2019, I gave that talk.
Mm-hmm. So, and you know, where have we gone in terms of fortifying any protection against that threat of deepfakes and more broadly, the threat of invasions of our privacy and how they can manipulate real information and outcomes of you know, democratic processes?
So, you know, we're just to set the stage, you know, so when I first gave that talk, there was something like 15,000 deep fake videos that were detected online, and 99% of them were of women, right? Of deep fake sex videos, women's faces being inserted into porn. Now today, there are over 50,000 deep fake imagery that's being, you know, video and audio being detected online. And again, 96% of it is women's faces being inserted into porn. So I always say that women are the canaries in the coal mine, that the kinds of disruptive uses of deepfake imagery is just portends problems down the roads. And so that's what I talked about in my TED Talk, was the concern that we would see deepfakes used to accomplish election mischief. And other ways that we might see like democracy undermining efforts. And we've seen some of it, right? We've seen deep fakes in India used to actually by a candidate to make them seem that they could speak different languages that they don't, dialects that they didn't speak, right? So in a way it was mischievously used, right, to deceive, but by the candidate himself. And we've also seen, I think it was Pakistan, where we've seen uses of deep fakes to undermine a candidate, to show them doing and saying something that they never did. But what lies ahead of us, I fear, is uses of deep fakes that do two things. One is that it's fake, right? And that the timed right, like the night before an election, you see an election turned. At the same time, and I think we've already discovered the other downside, which is the existence of deep fakery and its persuasiveness allows people to say, everything is fake. Don't believe that video of my actual mischief, right? My co-author, Bobby Chesney, and I call that the liar's dividend. And I fear that we're here, right? The here and the now of trust decay is we are living in it, unfortunately, right? And deep fakes just makes matters worse, right?
When you see those examples from India, Pakistan, and think of the potential threat in the United States, which hasn't been fully realized in the political impact.
Right.
You're talking about the social impact and, you know, the impact of violations of women's trust and their rights. But when you see those examples from elsewhere around the world, in what way are you most concerned about that manipulation taking place in these next few years here?
What most worries me, I think, is sort of politicians using deepfakery to show their political opponents doing and saying things that they never did or said, or activists, you know, doing and saying things that they never did or said to discredit real important rights and movements on the ground. And, you know, in some respects, we've seen the liar's dividend already. You know, Trump, when he was in office, said of the Access Hollywood tape, oh, that wasn't me. That wasn't my voice, right? He tried the gambit of saying it's all fake, don't believe it, in many ways didn't take off because it was very difficult to believe anything he said. But people are already living in that world of like, you have some proof of my wrongdoing? That's not real, right? And I guess I had every election like since I've been studying deep fakes, I just pray a little, like two days before, right? Because, you know, the sophistication of, you know, the kinds of ops that we've seen from foreign actors, you know, domestic actors, the use of falsehoods to sway the electorate is already profoundly afoot, right? We're already seeing, whether it's QAnon or falsehoods about Hunter Biden's laptop, whatever it may be, right? We see falsehoods perpetrated or facts, real facts taken out of context and misused. And so I think we have elections before us in which I worry that, you know, people of good faith will be undermined. That is, their candidacies will be undermined in ways that make it very difficult, because you can't redo an election, right? We have an election. And if the deep fakery comes out like the night or two before, right, you don't say do-over, right? It's just a smash democracy, right? And I think what follows from that is just that we already have such deep distrust of government. I think something like 30%, we have massive distrust, so that only 30% of people say they remotely trust Congress, the president, the Article 3 and the court system. And that's a dangerous place to be in, right? So that, and especially the distrust, which I think is so upsetting, is of the mass media. That is the fourth estate. They are the guardians at the gate, right, to truth. And the idea that we would have this like complete lack of faith in their findings, right, of real repositories of trust, have we just so eroded that? And so, I think we all need a lesson in civic engagement. Right, each and every one of us, not just young people, but I worry that we could be in many cases like before an election. That's some of the work that Rick is doing in his UCLA project, and safeguarding democracy is to, in some sense, educate us so that we can help ourselves, right?
Yes.
From the mischief.
Danielle's referring to the UCLA Safeguarding Democracy project, on which she is an advisor and contributor to those efforts. I think the testimonies ongoing regarding the events of January 6th show that you can see horrible things that are not fake. And for those not familiar with deep fakes, you know, the construction of manipulated video, taking someone's real face or presence and giving them words that they didn't actually say, but it looks like they said those words. In the event of the January 6th documentary and the videos that have been exposed by the committee, you, in a sense, in terms of looking at the deterioration of civil order, don't need anything fake or inauthentic to see the tension and the very active threat to the transfer of democratic right. power in our country. How does that factor in that these very awful real events took place? Yeah. They weren't manipulated video. They were real, in terms of mm-hmm. the disbelief and inauthentic content. What do you think about in the context of our democracy and deepfakes when you think of January 6th and those videos?
I think it just goes to show that, of course, all that was premised on a falsehood. Right, that the election was stolen and that we had massive voter fraud and that voting machines, you know, somehow flipped votes at a massive scale. Right. And so what worries me is that someone who has the trust of so many people, if that person is a would-be tyrant, right, that the lies that he told didn't need us to see them, right? He just said them, like the election was stolen and we know, and he made up facts at the ready, right? But what's even more potent is if he had video, right? Remember there was one video clip in which he was like saying, oh, that video clip shows that someone is passing like a disc or whatever it was, like passing. And it was just people exchanging what they're doing, their jobs. And that was pointed to, and that of course was a true video of someone's handing someone something else, completely benign, but then used to shore up his fakery, right? The big lie.
Yeah.
And I think what I worry about, so we did have some audio and video in there, right? It was just a misdirection. It was a lie. about what that was. And my deep worry is that when you have a charismatic figure who people believe, who will believe lies that are just, you know, words, right? With a little video, but really words, that we know that video and audio is so potent. It hits us in the gut. Recall that when we're watching these hearings for one sec, when we get to see the videotape and someone talking, there's nothing better or to show clips, right, of the events. We rely on video and audio to have proof of the world because we don't need anything else to bear witness. We just say we have our eyes and ears. We see it, right? It's visceral. It punches us in the gut. We say, of course it's true. We saw it. So my worry is that if president as president, Trump was so successful telling lies that were just words, right? That if he points to faked video and audio, that's a recipe for disaster, right? Many more people will believe it. And so to me, it's just preparation for the future. And I'm not saying it's going to be Trump. It could be somebody else.
Right. I guess what we have going for us is that the act of depicting a stolen election, you know, in terms of chads and voting machines, it's just not a very sexy thing. I mean, you started talking about porn. And the fact that, you know, this was criminalizing women and doing these acts that were, you know, considered by some to be unethical or immoral or whatever. In this case, the best you could have, I suppose, is, you know, a group of 100 people who go on camera saying, you know, that they tainted computers or systems of elections, and people weren't doing that. So I suppose you could invent a 60 minutes, if you will, a faux 60 minutes report where all these fake people are saying that this was stolen, right?
Oh, I mean, that's kind of... I have a much more mischievous mind than you are. So maybe I shouldn't give people ideas. But, you know, think of Brad Raffensperger, right? The Georgia Secretary of State. And imagine a deep fake of him. And it looks like him. It sounds like him saying something like to the line, you know, to reaffirming that it was all stolen. And we're just covering it. Like,
and preempting.
That makes sense. So that's the potent stuff, right? Rather than like, right? I mean, I think we could come up with other things.
Well, especially preempting the real Raffensperger.
Right. And say like, oh, you're lying. Like we saw you on tape. You know what I mean? Like you're just trying to cover your, just imagine how a tyrant can spin it.
Right. Because sowing that seeds of doubt and having a fake Raffensperger come on and then he comes out and says that wasn't me.
Yep.
Have those people who wanted to believe the first iteration and now disbelieve the second. And so I hear what you're saying.
It's like chaos, right? And confirmation bias, as you said, like when you see something that confirms what you already believe, you believe it. You're like, that's proof. I don't need anything else. Right. Yeah. And so it creates such discord, right, in our electorate.
Now, let me ask you a question in a broader sense about your expertise in cyber hygiene and, you know, what basically occurs online. We're behaving like there's still a pandemic because there still is a pandemic. And a lot of people in America aren't right now. But, you know, we're recording this in this climate of still growing pestilence and variants of this new disease and other potential diseases. In this climate, many of us have operated online and have a renewed appreciation or maybe a first-time appreciation of the sanctity of privacy online. Yep. Folks who didn't think about what browser they used or where they bought their products. And now over these past 2.5-3 years, they're considering that in their decision-making, who's tracking me and what is my digital footprint and how does it protect or shield my privacy or not? Mm-hmm. So have you found that there is a more mature constituency of digital actors' behavior than before the pandemic or not?
Some of the most difficult thing is, you know, as you think about hygiene as an individual thing, that is what any one of us can do is so limited. It's really a systemic problem. And so that's why in my new book, The Fight for Privacy, I talk about ways in which we need companies, governments, platforms to view our intimate information and to be the caretakers of that information, right? To not collect it. Some stuff you don't collect, some stuff you don't sell or should never sell, right? Intimate information. And so there's only so much that each and every one of us can do, because we see a privacy policy and we think, okay, we're good. We click on through. And even if we objected, right? But there's so little that any one of us can do, right? We have few rights that are guaranteed in law, and we need to change that, right? So we got problems that we need to change with the architecture of the way these services are built, how these companies collect data, share it, and sell it. And then, of course, like that robust market of data brokers need to be regulated. So in some sense, it's bigger than us, right? It's centrally about our life opportunities, our ability to love and to, you know, have form relationships and to become our authentic selves, right? And to enjoy dignity. But in a way, it's almost out of our hands because it's so structural. I know that's depressing. I have some tips at the end of my book, but really, like, it's very, I say, like, there's only so much we can do. I'm going to give you 10 things, but caution.
I don't mean to make this contentious at all, but I would not like to believe what you're saying in terms of these systems being cooked already or rigged.
Oh, we can undo it, right? It doesn't mean that companies can't change it. Right. I work with companies on the inside all the time, right? Twitter, Facebook, Spotify, Bumble, TikTok. You know, I advise these companies. And so they're building products and services right now that I'm urging them to build in as they build them with privacy and safety in mind. And they can do it, right? So it's, I'm not saying it's useless, right? But I'm saying it's difficult for us to say to the 4,000 data brokers, Alex, do you have time or do your friends have time to go to each and every one of them to say, please delete my data? And you know what they're going to say to you? Too bad, so sad. I don't care what you think. You have no right to ask me to delete it. So in a way, I feel overwhelmed myself. Maybe I'm just overcompensating for my own sense of inadequacy of what I can do to protect my own privacy.
Right. No, I hear you. And for those viewing this, you know, Danielle is really the nation and maybe even the world's leading expert on this. And go find her book when it comes out, The Fight for Privacy, Protecting Dignity, Identity, and Love in the Digital Age by W.W. Norton and Penguin Vintage UK this fall. What's disheartening about about that idea, and again, you just said, well, we can change course, the ship hasn't totally sailed, is you know, the fact that Firefox and Wikipedia have been the exception to the rule of institutions online. And when I say that, for those who aren't familiar, Firefox being the browser that has pledged for eternity not to sell your data, Wikipedia being a source of information that is not profit-driven and that has a true democratic and increasingly diverse gender-based audience and editing group. But my question to you is, when you talk about systemic flaws and failures and your work inside of these companies to make things better, how are you trying to make things better where we are now? Which is that the incentives that drove Firefox and Wikipedia to be the exceptions to the rule, well, it seems like for a decade plus, whatever Web 2.0 became, it was driven by the opposite incentives.
That's right. I mean, the market on its own, the incentive is to collect as much as you can, personal data, share, sell, right? And so the market incentives are such that there's little reason for companies to distinguish themselves on privacy, because the real upside, that is the money, is with the sale of data and the purchase of data. And just to collect it for your own purposes, some of these biggest companies like Amazon, they're probably not selling it, they're amassing it because they're thinking someday they're going into healthcare, right? That is, you can't think to yourself, okay, they're all selling it. They may not all be selling it, but they're amassing it and they can use it against you, right? And ultimately, right, in ways that aggrandize their power. But so how do you get companies to, what's the moral suasion, right, that we can bring to bear that more of them are Wikipedia, that more of them are akin to Mozilla, right, the Firefox approach to not selling data? And I think we just start talking, right? Like, how is it? Because I think if these companies actually think we're walking, right? It's only when advertisers, especially true of some of these companies like Facebook, like they're not going to change anything until advertisers say, well, we're not going to, we're not going to use your services. We're going to move on. We don't like your platform showing non-consensual pornography, right? Or whatever, you know, rape joke pages, as in 2014, we saw Facebook move because advertisers pressured them, right? So how do we do that? Look, I mean, it's not like we don't have a voice. The problem is it's scale, right? Like we all have to leave Instagram, Facebook to get them to do anything, right? And maybe, Alex, like here we are on your show, right? This is the moment in which we tell everyone, vote with your mouths and feet, right? Like you're not into this, Instagram. We don't like you selling our data, exploiting it, manipulating us. Then we say that, right? But we'd have to walk too. And so that, and given network effects, like, where am I going to go? You know what I'm saying? All my friends are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, right? Like I can't recreate those communities. I guess I have a few group texts, but they're only like 10 of us, right? And so it's very hard to convince people to leave. Does that make sense? Like I can leave, sure. But like everyday person is going to say like, but how am I going to see my college friends, high school friends, photos, right? It's because these are protected networks, right? That we cherish. It's hard to walk away.
Sure. And there was the hope that Facebook and Instagram were not the end game.
Right.
So you.
I'm still hopeful, right? Look, TikTok is pretty, right? Like remember MySpace was and then it wasn't. You know what I mean? Like Julia Angren wrote a whole book about MySpace and it's like.
No, I hear you, but it's been, I don't think it can be dumbed down anymore, right? I mean, we're at the dumbest point with the least amount of context, the least amount of the things that you value. And one of the things you value is the law of this country. And we are where we are possibly because the nation has not practiced what it's preached in terms of antitrust. Yes. And we haven't really preached much antitrust anyway in the last half century, right?
Yeah.
Bottom line is, I don't think there's a real dynamic shift here because we've reached that dumbest point of no return. Forgive me, but
no, I mean, we're kind of dumb.
And so where we are possibly could change as a result of actual antitrust enforcement. But there's no evidence, and I would ask you and your colleagues at the law school this question, there's no evidence there ever will be the kind of antitrust movement that would make Facebook have to break up or that whole network, Alphabet, Facebook, Twitter, others. There doesn't seem any evidence of that.
I mean, the FTC is thinking hard, right? So we have Lina Khan, who's the chair of the FTC. We've got new commissioners. We have a really interesting group, thoughtful group of commissioners. They're sending signals that they're thinking about privacy and antitrust as one story, which it is, right? What makes these companies powerful is they're buying and selling, they're amassing our personal information. But I think we also need like antitrust could be part of that story, but we need strong privacy laws because the entire problem is the business model is totally permissible.
Right.
Like, as you were saying, if we go back to incentives, their market incentives are all on the side of collect more and more and more and sell more and more and more. And there's no law or very little. It's
I mean, I see these two things, and maybe my imagination is getting sort of away from the reality, but I see those two things, Danielle, as connected.
Yeah, of
the
course.
The absence of privacy standards are a pretext or legitimate legal motivation for antitrust to get busy.
Fair? Oh, that's right. Oh, yes. I mean, they should be sort of like levers of power that we can press on that helps us. So we're inadequate on privacy. Let's work on antitrust. Like we need to constrain power of these companies.
Yeah. But I would think those colleagues you mentioned that would be the grounds and that would have been the grounds in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal.
Yes.
We have antitrust grounds here because you're not comporting with the law. Or even take, the FEC, which has been, largely absent from the whole conversation around anonymous spending in rubles and other currencies during the 2016 election, which was still never resolved.
Right.
The testimonies of these executives saying, we don't know who bought ads, 2016.
They're just paid never, in rubles.
Right. Whatever like currency. Total
absurdity that is, right?
So I'll kind of, to close, ask you a question that I asked Carissa Valise, who's also in the space.
Oh, nice. Yes. Terrific.
You know, I was asking her about a way for the citizen to do more than just boycott. So boycotting is one thing, but I thought, and I proposed to Carissa, there ought to be some sort of master class of doing this and some kind of app you can download that can tell you how much privacy you're in effect losing using all the rest of the apps on your phone.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be so great? And I think some of the problem too is like, you know, these apps will say it's our trade secret. You can't know what we're doing. That is, even though, of course, advertisers, marketers, and data brokers have an invitation to buy. So it's sort of like this odd, you know, we can't tell you, but we'll tell everybody else. And wouldn't it be great if we had like that, that is privacy was profit, right? That I could pay for an app that would give me some transparency. And I think what we would see is just the sucking of our data everywhere, right? That is, there are some computer scientists that will have like create visuals for us to show the thousands of parties, right? That that your one app is selling to, right? And then and ad infinitum, you know, selling to thousands more. And it's really hard for us, right? To get, I'm sure Carissa said this as well in her wonderful book, like, the idea that we can see it viscerally, we can't. We don't see data popping out of my hands, into my fingers, you know, out my fingers, and then onto this stream, right, into these reservoirs of my intimate information.
Right. Danielle, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me. I so appreciate it.
Please visit the Open Mind website at 13.org/openmind to view this program online or to access over 1,500 other interviews. And do check us out on Twitter and Facebook at Open Mind TV for updates on future programming.
Continuing production of The Open Mind has been made possible by grants from Ann Olnick, Joan Gans Cooney, Lawrence B. Benenson, the Engelson Family Foundation, Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, Joanne and Kenneth Wellner Foundation, and from the corporate community, Mutual of America.